coming on the Agony Column podcast, Susanna Moore's new novel is The Big Girls.
The book originated in my wish to write about motherhood.
But she took a turn to the dark side.
I pushed it to its limit and decided to write about someone who kills her children.
All in the interest of literature.
Someone once asked me, why don't you write about nice people? And of course, the answer is that nice people aren't very interesting. They are not that compelling.
Compelling reading, coming on the Agony Column podcast. You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony. I've decided to include two readings from Susanna Moore's new book, The Big Girls. The first is from the point of view of Dr. Louise Forrest.
Helen is a 28-year-old woman of Scotch-Irish and Polish descent. She grew up in a working-class family on Long Island, New York. She has one sibling, a younger brother named Kelly, who serves in the United States Army. Previous to her recent incarceration, she had no criminal record, although she has a substantial psychiatric history. She has succeeded in cutting herself twice since her arrival at the prison last June, using the lenses of her glasses and the crucifix of a rosary. Her thin forearms are ringed with old and new scars. As she expected, even wished to be put to death for her crime, she believes that her sentence is not sufficiently severe. She has subsequently devised her own means of punishment, which is to eat as little as possible, at the same time satisfying a craving for sugar. She lives on Snowcap's candy, eating 3 to 4 boxes a day. She told me that if she could have one wish in the world, it would be to eat pizza with her son, Shane. She will not touch the packages of food that her mother occasionally sends, but gives them to other inmates. I've discussed her diet with the prison doctor, Dr. Subramania, but short of feeding her by force, there is nothing that can be done. I've requested that she be given an eye exam. She is very attached to her glasses, which are broken, cleaning them frequently with that solemn concern demonstrated by people who have worn glasses since childhood. There was something in my face, perhaps, or in my voice, when she spoke of her children today, that caused her to ask if I too had children. Of course I couldn't answer her. She rarely speaks of her husband, who is a Pentecostal Christian, except to say that he must hate her. I would hate myself if I knew me, she said.
The second reading is from the point of view of Helen, who is an abuse survivor who has murdered her own children. I want to warn readers that portions of this narrative may be disturbing.
It's St. Patrick's Day. In the kitchen, they will dye everything they can get their hands on green. Green cottage cheese, green fruit cocktail, green rice. I won't be eating any of it, even if it wasn't green. I was supposed to give Wanda my answer about being in her family, and I did. This is a big step for me. I never knew a lesbian in my life, and if I did, I didn't know it. I said I'd be honored to be in her family. There is a ceremony in the beginning of next month to introduce me. Wanda always gives you something religious when you join. I got a blue medal of St. Christopher carrying a baby. It's the Catholics who wear medals usually, but that doesn't bother me. Uncle Dad's first wife was a Catholic, so his children with her were brought up Catholic. I was always a little jealous of their school uniform. Patty's was a green plaid jumper and a little white blouse with a collar. I don't know if Uncle Dad ever made his own girls do the things he made me and Ellie do, but my guess is he didn't. They didn't live with us, but I think I'd have known if he did. Ellie definitely knows, but she's not telling. She's good at keeping secrets. I guess I am beginning to know certain things myself now, even if I fight against it. I don't say remember because Dr. Forrest says I never forgot. She says for most of my life I wouldn't let myself know. She is only partly right. She thinks she knows everything, but there are things I haven't told her. It would begin in the tub. He would turn out the light in the bathroom while he was giving me a bath, and it was the strangest feeling being in that warm water in the darkness. It was like it was all around you, but you couldn't tell what it was. Were you floating in darkness, or were you floating in water? It was different when he came to my room. Then I was floating in air, looking down at us. Later, after I had Shane and Kaylee, he would come by when Jimmy was at work. I was floating then, too, but that was because of the medicine Dr. Kirgorin gave me. He stopped for a while after Shane was born, but not for long. I thought it was because I lost my figure, and I got back in shape as fast as I could. That is an example of what Dr. Forrest says happens to people. The person who is abused wants her abuser to like her. When I thought about that, I knew it was true. But when Dr. Forrest first said it, I couldn't admit it. It just made me so sad. I cried for days after that. Some things are very terrible.
Susanna Moore is the author of My Old Sweetheart, The Whiteness of Bones and Sleeping Beauties. In 1995, she published In the Cut, and in 2003, One Last Look. Her new novel is The Big Girls. Welcome to the program, Susanna.
Yes, hi, Rick.
This is a very disturbing and dark book, but you've chosen a really unique storytelling method. Tell us a little bit about why you chose the method of storytelling that you chose to tell this sort of story.
I fell in love with the first-person narrative when I was writing In the Cut. I had never done it before. I had, in all the previous books, the three previous, I had written in the third person, and they have a kind of formality and a kind of detachment. Perhaps in part because they were so autobiographical, it was helpful, ironically, not to write it in the first person. But after In the Cut, I was completely seduced by the first person. So I knew that I wanted to write it in that form. I also was rather interested in the idea of the unreliable narrator, by which I don't mean a narrator who is lying to you all the time or dishonest, but that you, through the course of the story, are not sure of the truth, like in life. And so I thought that to have different voices often reflecting on the same events would be a way to illustrate that. And also, what better place than a prison in which you, and a psychiatrist, in which you are, the people who are speaking to you are evasive or not necessarily telling the truth or bound to a kind of mythos about themselves that they have created, or in this case of the psychiatrist, speaking elliptically. And I thought that the odd, funny four separate voices would work.
Tell us a little bit about what the setup of the book is. We have a psychiatrist who's seen a patient in prison. Tell us a little bit about that patient and some of the other voices in the book.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, and it's funny in the comical sense, I realize, because when I say it, not meaning to be humorous, people laugh. Now, of course, I can see the humor now. But the book originated in my wish to write about motherhood. I had written a lot about having a mother. The first, you see, you're even smiling.
Yes.
The first three books are about a mother and written really more or less from the child. And with each book, the child is a little older until she's a woman. But I had never written about what it is like to have a child. And there was a quote that I think is William Faulkner, although I have never been able to find it again, but it has stuck in my mind. And the quote is, after becoming a parent, he was never again happy in the same way. And that was something that, as a parent, I felt very strongly. I recognize that not all parents feel this way, but I was very conscious as a parent of my feelings occasioned by having a child, of grief and, I suppose, rage, although that's much more unconscious, but certainly grief and certainly anxiety. So I wanted to write about that. And as is my wont, I pushed it to its limit and decided to write about someone who kills her children. And I have a daughter who's 30, and when she discovered that this was how my wish to write a book about maternity was manifesting itself, was quite, I have to say, startled. And she didn't say anything for a few days, and she came back to me and said, "Oh, Mama, you can be honest with me, but does this mean that you wanted to kill me?" I, of course, said, "No, not at all."
You have a really great phrase in here where you describe that the love for a child is like a stomach ache, which I think is a really apropos, because there's a constant gnawing worry when you have children. Yes. That something will happen to them.
Yes. That's really what interested me, and I felt that stomach ache very strongly. And the anxiety when they're not in your presence, the fantasy that you can absolutely protect them. Of course, you can protect them up to a point. And it also has to do with a kind of, I think, an identification about loss of innocence. Because I notice in myself, and when people tell stories about their children, that the stories that are most painful reflect the child's loss of innocence. And I think that is because it corresponds to a loss of innocence in oneself that one is still grieving about.
You've created a really interesting character in this novel, Helen. She's the woman who's incarcerated for murdering her children. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about how you went about creating somebody who most readers are going to think of, if you don't know her through your prose, as a monster, and yet how you create sympathy for the devil.
Well, another thing that interested me when I was thinking about writing this book was the idea that you could kill your children and be sane, which, of course, as we know, is a belief certainly of judges, juries, prosecuting attorneys, the press, public. It was not a belief I ever held. I always, did fight to attest that if you killed your children, you were just by the very act insane. And then also I was very upset on behalf of women who were, rather than being treated, were locked up and some executed. I mean, for example, now there are 45 women on death row in America, 11 of whom have killed their children. I thought these women should be treated in hospitals and then, if cured, let go. I didn't think they should be locked up for the rest of their lives or in fact, killed. So when I began to do research, which I did for about a year and a half by reading everything I could find, from scholarly monographs on psychosis to the court TV website has a very interesting, quite ghoulish archive where you can look up all sorts of crime. I mean, you can go to this site and put in cannibalism and 10 stories will pop up. All true. And so a lot of my research came from that, in fact. And the quote in the book, you know, about the man that was executed in 1938 who boiled his victim and ate her, that comes from
Albert Fish.
From the Daily News, the archives of the Daily News. So I made up less than one would think. But when I was doing my research, I was rather startled to discover that I was beginning to change my mind a little bit. And it suddenly seemed possible that some of these women were less insane than I, in fact, would like them to be in order to justify what they did. And there were some who were more likable, if I can use that word, than others. And Susan Smith, for example, is very difficult to like because of her personality and her behavior and the little details of her crime and her accusations and things she did later, and which, of course, to me is slightly, makes me smile at myself because it has an element of irrationality. You know, if I'm going to support these women, whether I like them or not has nothing to do with my beliefs. But, of course, it creeps in. You can't help it.
I find what you say pretty interesting, just by virtue of the fact that Helen, your main character, she starts out the book wanting to die, And as a reader, I could understand that totally. Tell us a little bit about that kind of conflict within the character and within yourself.
Well, I was very intent when I sat down to write the book and to write about Helen, that this was not going to be a book about someone who was either imprisoned unfairly, in the sense that she was innocent, nor about a prisoner who thinks that she has been imprisoned unfairly. I wanted it to be very clear that Helen took full responsibility for her crime. That she was psychotic is not clear to her. And the irony, of course, in the book, which is true for all right-thinking, by that I mean sympathetic psychiatrists and social workers in prison, is that the treatments usually in this term, in the sense of medicine as well as therapy, that is given to prisoners increases their despair, because as they become more conscious of what has happened to them and less crazy, of course, the guilt and horror increases. So there's a certain irony in that, which Dr. Forrest talks about, and even Helen herself says that, you know, the saner she becomes, the more suicidal she becomes, because she is forced to see what she has done.
You have a really fascinating portrait of women's prisons in this book. It has a lot of stuff that I don't think any of us ever suspected about the families in prison. And in fact, this novel has a lot to do with families, because our families inside and outside of prison, and in some ways the ones in prison, are a little bit more functional than the ones outside.
That was the other thing that was my theme. I did, in wanting to write about what it is to be a mother, of course, was writing about what it is to be in a family. And I'm glad that you said that, because the book, to me, is about two things: families and celebrity. They're disparate, but they're brought together through Helen and through the Hollywood actress. But yes, I think the book is very much, and in an extreme way, exaggerated way, about primal anarchy and primal rage, and all about the relationship. I mean, there are many, many relationships in the book between parents and children. Almost everybody, whether it's Ike or the movie star or the other prisoners, or certainly the psychiatrist, certainly Helen, it's the subject that with which they are involved, or and in a way obsessed, is family. And then it's mirrored by something that was a discovery to me, which I thought was thrilling when I read about it, because it was as if I were given a metaphor, which is that in women's prisons there is this long tradition of very elaborate, hierarchical, complicated, subtle, emotional families that are made up of all women, but the women play the male roles as well as the female, and all different ages. So their grandfathers and their uncles, as well as aunts and cousins and sisters and mothers and fathers, of course, and their very strict rules. There are divorces, there are rules against incest, there are baptisms, there are engagements, there are confirmations, there are deaths. And this interior family that is constructed in women's prisons keeps them alive, I think.
Tell us a little bit about your work in a prison.
Well, you would think that my work began before I wrote the book, or my work perhaps led to an interest in these women, but it was ironically the opposite, that I did my research reading and then wrote the book. And then I think the simplest way to put it is that I had fallen in love with Helen, and I felt that I wanted to do something for women in prison. And then it was then that I volunteered to teach this writing class in a women's prison, and did.
But that didn't last too long, did it?
No, it didn't last too long. I got thrown out for bringing in contraband, which was yarn and writing paper and magazines, which I had been bringing in openly, you know, in my hands all along. But for reasons that we, none of us, prisoners, myself, some of the officers can figure out, we don't know quite what happened, except that they had, the administration had had enough of me. Maybe they thought I was a troublemaker. I don't know. I wasn't. I certainly wasn't.
One thing I found really interesting about this book was the kind of oral history style, in that you have these four different narrators rotating between their voices. You do some really subtle things to make sure every time we encounter a new section told by a new voice that we immediately know how it is, who it is who's speaking. Could you talk a little bit about the crafting of that? Because it's very subtle, but it's also very helpful when you're reading.
Well, I think when I wrote the first few drafts, I think it was much less clear who was speaking. And in fact, I have a friend who said to me, "Oh, this book is such an interesting study of a split personality." She actually thought it was one person who was taking all of these, slipping into all of these roles. And so I realized, because I do believe that the reader is almost always right. You know, if something's not working, it's your fault. So I was very careful to go back and to fix it. And if I were teaching, which I do, but if I were teaching how to do this, you know, it's very simple, which is that in the opening line of each paragraph of a new voice, I slip in a word or two that makes it very clear who it is. So if you were noticing it, you would see it would say "my patient" or "today in Manhattan" or "in my cell" or "I have no windows in my cell." There's something almost in every first line that helps you to know who is speaking.
You say you went through several drafts of this book. I'm curious, this is a very clean book. When I read this, I just feel like it's just scrubbed to perfection and very polished. Did you write each section separately? Did you write it in order?
No, I didn't write it in alternating voices. I did not. It's not as if I wrote all of Helen and then all of Dr. Forrest and spliced them together in some way. Although there was some rearranging, of course, you know, and also because I don't know a lot about how a book will turn out, I often have to go back and insert things to give it a kind of cohesion and continuity and clarity. So that if, you know, Captain Bradshaw, who came into the story rather late, once Captain Bradshaw is born, I have to make sure, you know, 50 pages later, Dr. Forrest notices him in the hall. You know, so you're adjusting things like that always. All writers do, I think.
One of the things, I guess, that interested me is there's a lot of hallucinations in this book. Helen is hallucinating a lot. And I think a lot of the hallucinations have this kind of Christian imagery. And it made me think that a lot of the most horrific things that you describe in here are things that you might actually find in the Bible at some point or another. And I'm wondering if you care to comment on how Christian imagery is this font of terror and hallucination.
Well, it's a font of sort of violence and the retribution of an angry God and punishment and sin and damnation, and she is crazy. You know, I there is no way that Helen could not be crazy in this book. For me, I suppose someone could write a book about another kind of Helen, but Helen slips in and out of her psychosis, and her psychosis is not only manifested in this splitting off of personality, which she does with her imaginary friend Ellie, which is very, very common in children who are abused or people who suffer traumatically, which is that they split themselves into two in order to bear what has happened. Otherwise, literally, they could not. I mean, they would be, she would have been an insane 5-year-old if she hadn't been able to do that. And then also, like a lot of abused children, you know, her sense of guilt and sense of responsibility is so strong that it also pushes her over the edge. You know, abused children often feel that it is their fault. And it's very complicated, you know, because of sometimes the refusal of other adults to believe them, the as she mentioned in the passage I read, the wish to be loved. Then there's the other aspect, which I don't really write about, which is about the what a friend of mine says is the body as machine, whereas the child actually unwillingly and innocently experiences pleasure, so it becomes completely confused in the child's mind with, I mean, this is what some people believe is how sadomasochism is, you know, starts in a person. So the Christian imagery, I mean, I think the Christian religion is very harsh and very unforgiving and very, very punishing, even of children.
Louise Forrest herself, the doctor, is sick. She refers to herself as a masochist. So you have yet another unreliable narrator in your character who's even sane.
She's a masochist in the way many women are masochists, you know, which is, and because she's a psychiatrist, she recognizes it and can put a name to it and can accept it in herself and joke about it and tease herself about it. I mean, she's not a masochist in the sense that she goes home after work and has herself tied up and beaten, but she recognizes the masochism in her fantasies, which is that masochism is, although it's quite unfashionable for a woman to say it, you know, is not uncommon.
This novel is filled with a series of events and descriptions that are discomforting, unpleasant, difficult to read, and difficult to encompass. As a reader, you make it palatable by virtue, I think, of the prose. But as a writer, wasn't this a tough to immerse yourself in all this this horror, particularly the child abuse?
It was very hard to go back to this world each day, I have to say. And of course, in the beginning, it was less hard. And then as it progressed and I got deeper and deeper into this world, it was sometimes unbearable. And I also think lately, because I've had to think about the book as a book, finished, written, being read by other people, that it's full of a kind of anger and that I am taking little pot shots all along the way at whether it's Christian fundamentalists or anti-abortionists or the people at Guantanamo, or even poor Yoko Ono gets a little bit of a slap. And I think that I resort to that in a way to shock people into thinking about things. Although I have to say, and it probably sounds disingenuous, I never begin with that intention. I really have very strong feelings about the didacticism in a book. In other words, that should be none. And that almost in a way, a writer should have as, the writer's point of view should be so subtle as to be almost indiscernible. I mean, I know that's often not the case, and I can't even claim that I succeed in this book, because I think my point of view is very obvious, don't you think?
Yeah, it's quite obvious.
Quite fervent.
But it's not, I don't think it's hammered, it does not seem didactic.
Good,
It seems very dispassionate.
And this a little is, cold, which is a way of not being didactic.
Right. There's a distancing effect by virtue of the way it's almost reportorial, just because you feel like we're reading different parts of different people's diaries.
Yes.
Almost.
Yes, I do that on purpose. It has a kind of flatness and lack of emotionalism in part to keep it from being two things, either didactic or sentimental.
Or sensational. Although it is very shocking. You just have one horrific aside after another in this book that's very disturbing. And I'm wondering, do you think we're just more aware of that now, that this has always been around, or that we're just, are we seeing it more, or is there more of it?
I think we're more aware of it, and I also think, and as happens, we're more inured to it. I mean, if there's a website that you can go to and put in cannibalism, and there are four or five stories about people killing and eating children, and you know, which gets quite a few hits, and the prevalence of pornography. I think we are more aware and we are more jaded.
Doesn't a book like this make us more jaded?
Oh, God, I hope not. No, I don't think so. Do you think it would?
It arguably could, just by virtue of the fact that, you really deal with this kind of subject. I think the way you deal with it, it doesn't. But I'm wondering, when you were writing this book, were you thinking, I'm going to write about things that will make people cringe?
No, I never, ever think that. I never think that. And I, you know, this may come as a surprise, but I actually think the book has a lot of humor in it. I think the book is quite funny. I mean, someone last night at a reading said, did you intend to write a black comedy? And I was really startled because I would never go that far. And I said to this person, oh, my goodness, you think this is a black comedy? She said, well, sort of. So
there is a lot of humor. I won't dispute that. But I would be careful about pronouncing too much of it funny just by virtue of the fact that it's so deadly serious.
And dark. No, and of course, and to say it's a black comedy is, I think, inaccurate. I hope you would agree to that.
Yeah.
But did I want to make people cringe?
Because you talk of just about, I mean, not just the horrific crimes you recount, but just the situations and the observations you make at a personal level about the discomfort of the characters.
I think I was referring to that in part when I said that I have realized that there's a lot of anger in the book. So I think it's not so much an intention to make people cringe, but is to kind of prod people and to make them aware of how bad things are, and how bad things are in particular for women, and how bad things are in particular for black women, and how, you know, prisons now have become, I don't want to preach and I think statistics in the end often just remain statistics. But prisons now also are the holding pens for people who are mentally ill for good reasons. For the fact that there were constitutional rulings in which people were allowed out of mental hospitals, and also because it's much harder to lock somebody up now. It's not that easy. It used to be quite easy. That's a good thing. But the bad thing is what you do with these people who are mentally ill. And one of the solutions has been to put them in prison, where they suffer horribly.
There is some humor in the character of Angie, the Hollywood starlet. And I'm wondering, you had an encounter with Hollywood and when they filmed your book In the Cut. And I'm wondering how much of this character that we see here comes out of those experiences.
You know, Angie comes out of earlier experiences, which would be more accurate. When I was very young, I think 22, my first serious job, if you can call it serious, was as a script reader to Warren Beatty. And then later I did it for years for Jack Nicholson. And I was also married to a man who was much older than I was, and was a production designer, and who designed films like Chinatown and Dick Tracy, and, I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? So in my 20s, I was in that world, and it really comes from those days. I mean, I even had a brief, I even, in some of my bios, to my horror, it describes me as an actress, because I have this tiny little part, for example, in Shampoo. Because Warren, for the simple reason that Warren always thought my voice was hilarious. He used to start to laugh every time he heard me say good morning. So I have this tiny, tiny little scene in the beauty salon where I walk through and I ask the character something. So, but somehow in my biography now, I'm an actress. And that's really all it amounted to. I suppose publicists, you know, grab hold of anything they can, but it comes from those days.
One of the things this novel does very well, I thought, was as we get more and more details about who the people are, what has happened to them, and where they are at this moment, I think that this novel made me fear that much more was going to happen. I could see so many places where things could go really, really awfully wrong. At one point, you mention a hostage, that they have to be careful about a hostage situation. And we have her the doctor's son, who's also in some peril on both sides of the continent. And I'm wondering, as a writer, when you are creating this kind of, as you're writing this, you're creating a series of potential plots. And at any given stage of this book, it could go in a number of different ways. Did you have any of those alternate visions? Did you write those out?
Well, I think, too, in a novel, it's very important to have tension and conflict. You know, someone once asked me, why don't you write about nice people? And, of course, the answer is that nice people, at least in a novel, aren't very interesting. Maybe true in real life, too, but certainly in a novel, they are not that compelling. And I didn't think of hostage-taking, but just now, as you said it, I thought, what a good idea. I didn't think of that. What I did think was that, for a while, that Helen might kill Dr. Forrest. And there's even a line toward the end of the book in which Helen confesses that the voices, the messengers, have told her to kill Dr. Forrest. And we know, because of her history, that it was the messengers who told her to kill her children, which she did. But it seemed too melodramatic and not really something Helen would do. And as Helen becomes healthier, thanks to Dr. Forrest and her medicine, of course, Helen's self-loathing increases to the point where she herself cannot continue to live.
You know, that brings up a really interesting point for me. That something I found fascinating was what I call medicated prose. As the characters are medicated, I mean, we all know people who, like, personalities subtly and sometimes grossly shift when they're on medication. I'm wondering, did you know somebody whose personality has shifted on medication? Or how did you achieve some of those effects?
Well, you know, I am one of those people who came very late to the idea of psychopharmacology as being beneficial. I think I'm oddly old-fashioned, and I have been in the past quite resistant to the idea that everything is chemical. You know, I have a friend who's a doctor who says that even our dreams are chemical, that absolutely comes from what is happening in the brain and has nothing to do with anything but that. I mean, Freud would faint. But I was quite stubborn about it, I think, and perhaps a bit ignorant. And I slowly, because I have seen how it has saved people, come round. But I've also seen how it changes people. It's a little bit the way people used to talk about AA, you know, or people who stop drinking, you know, that, yes, it's better that you're sober, but, you know, you were really much more fun before. You know, that awful thing that people say. And that's been, that whole conversation now has been replaced by the one about medicine. And I think we still don't know everything about it. I went through a period of taking very mild antidepressants, Wellbutrin, in a period when I was very depressed, and I didn't like it at all, and I stopped. I thought it much better to be just depressed. Someone later asked me, well, how do you feel now that you've stopped taking your medicine? And of course, it was like being set up, a straight man, the obvious answer, you know, I feel really, really sad.
It interests me, too, that the use of Freud in the book. Freud has gone through all sorts of revolutions in psychiatry. That for a while it was considered science, and then he was discarded, and we've now recently had him return more as an artist and a writer, as opposed to somebody who really, like, discovered facts. So where do you stand on Freud?
That is really a perfect description of him. You know, that now, for example, his case study of Dora is taught in literature classes. You know, I was a little worried about the fact that Dr. Forrest is a Freudian, because it's extremely anachronistic. I mean, it's not amongst young psychiatrists and doctors. It is not cool to be a Freudian, and it's not. He's seen as a kind of, as you say, a grand old man, poetic. He had some interesting ideas. He made a lot of mistakes. He's exactly more of an artist, and an inspiration. And And things move so quickly now that even someone like, because I began to research it, you know, I thought, oh God, I better really be more up to date. But even someone like Lacan is already a bit dated. You know, there's a whole new trend in psychiatry and certainly treatment, which is, there's a name for it, I can't remember, but you know, you go for a specific problem. There's a name.
Well, the only thing I think of is neuroscience. I'm really interested in studying, you know, the electrical and chemical activity of the brain.
No, that too is very, very, very. But that's a good thing. This other. I mean, I like that. And I have a very good friend who's a forensic psychiatrist who was with me with every pill in this book and vetted it and helped me. But no, this other thing, what's popular in psychiatry now is you go for a particular problem and you discuss that, and you do not discuss your childhood or dreams or what your mother and father did to you as a child. And you only go for a certain period, you know, you go for a month or 2 months and then you can come back. But it's not about the unconscious. It's very practical. But that didn't interest me. I didn't want her to be that kind of doctor.
One thing that interests me too is that you have a really good way of having Helen describe incidents in her past and some of the other characters too, in a way that we know that when she describes some aspect of her childhood, we know that way back then, that things were really wrong with her, these kind of early warning signs. Could you talk about using those and integrating the whole science of psychiatry into your plot, making that a plot point? That's what this book turns on.
If she is, you know, psychotic, which she is, I suppose one could write a book, and it would be very modern, in which she just is psychotic. I mean, there is a trend now in literature not to have what they call a backstory. The backstory being a modern idea anyway. You know, you don't, when you're reading Return of the Native, we don't ever know anything about Eustacia Vye's childhood. It was important to trace her development as a woman and as this absolutely doomed victim without, again, making it sentimental or without causing it to be what I would call too squishy. You know, it needed a kind of, I hope it has a kind of toughness, the book, in that way, that it's not soft in the way self-help books are. Or
absolutely not.
I hope not. I hate self-help books.
Have you had much of a reaction from abuse survivors to this book? I mean, what do they think of this book?
You know, I have not had any reaction. I mean, it's early. The two of the incidents in the book happened to a friend of mine, the same friend of mine. And after I wrote it, I sent her the manuscript and asked her, she had told me these stories, and I asked her if it was all right for me to use them, and that, of course, if she didn't want me, of course it doesn't use her name or refer to her in any way. And she said that she read the pages and wept for days, and then said, of course, that I could use them. I will be interested. I would like to know what people think. I mean, as we discussed earlier, supposedly one in four women have suffered sexual abuse. So I don't know if it's the sort of thing, though, say at a reading you raise your hand and announce. I mean, perhaps I will get letters.
I would presume so. I'm curious, too, when you write such an extreme book, this is, to me, in many ways, is a horror novel. I mean, It scares the bejesus out of me, just in terms of showing what humans are capable of, and humans, moreover, who live in a civilized and polite society. Did you think of this as a horror novel?
No, I really didn't. I thought, you know, all of my books are about women, and it remains the great challenge to me, and the great temptation, and the great anxiety to write a book from the point of view of a man. And I'm very conscious that I do not write about men, really. That men in my books, all of them, are secondary characters or supplemental. And well, I mean, maybe Malloy in The Cut is a male figure who's stronger. But my focus is really on women. So what? And I'm interested in... I suppose I have become more radical as I've gotten older and my books have become more extreme. But all of the things that are in this book can be found in the earlier books. You know, The Whiteness of Bones, which was only my second book, there's a child who's molested in like the first 20 pages. There's a woman is raped with a salt shaker. You know, there's you know, it has grotesquerie and violence. There is that in all of the books, certainly in The Cut. Yeah. And the Indian book, which is this mild, rather dense, I mean, I wrote it like a Victorian fruitcake, you know, packed with things that 19th century India, the central relationship is an incestuous one between a brother and sister. So I obviously can't leave it alone.
This brings up a phrase that I found in here that I found really fascinating, what you talk about, what you call grotesque symmetry. This book is just a series of grotesque symmetries. And I'm wondering, do you think that observing these and laying them out in beautiful, clear, concise, well-written prose that's understated and not sensational...
Does that have a grotesque symmetry? Yeah. I mean, is your question?
Well, is it good? Is it a good thing? Is this something?
You're making me think that you think that the book is decadent and will be. Do you think it will? In your opinion, I mean, again, it's this idea that it.
I don't think it's decadent, but I think that it's
dangerous.
No, I think it's fairly over the top.
Yes, it's very over the top.
And
that was on purpose, of course.
Right. Well, I'm wondering that I'm a person who's read a lot of horror novels, and that's kind of my background as a reviewer. So I'm somewhat used to this kind of thing. But I can imagine that, you know, the Saturday afternoon ladies book club picks this up and maybe does not have the same feeling.
I think I know what you're saying. Too, which is that the way that it's written, the prose,
mm-hmm.
in a way is, that's why I said decadent. It's not that it's glamorous, but that it in some way obfuscates or lessens what I'm saying, and yet at the same time, it exaggerates it.
It drives it home.
Yes. But to have written it, there's no other way to have written it. I couldn't have written it in an exclamatory, extreme way, because it would have made it sentimental and it would have made it bombastic, unreadable. I would think.
Right. Well, but I mean, when you choose these subjects, when you choose to write about this, I mean, you exclude a big part of the reading audience. Don't you think? I mean,
yes. But what can I do? I mean, you know, it's hard to write bad, but it's no, I would like very much to have as many people as possible read my books, but I don't know what, I mean, I don't know, I really don't know how to do it.
We've been speaking with Susanna Moore. Her new book is The Big Girl.
Do you have any suggestions? Any...
I think this is a finely written book. I really enjoyed it. I mean, the craft and the skill that went into this is remarkable, and even the way you treat the subject is remarkable. But as I'm reading, I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't even like begin to broach the subjects of this book to my wife.
You can't? You don't think?
No. I mean, she just doesn't want to hear it. I mean, we have children ourselves, so the whole. You know,
I do think that there is something in it that does make you uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable.
That's
unsettled.
That's true, but don't. I'm just wondering, isn't that not part of your point to make people unsettled with this book? I mean,
yes, but I want them to be unsettled by the subjects. You know, women in prison, child abuse, the anarchy in families. Not you're unsettled by something much more subtle, which is just the, in fact, the sort of form of it and the way you experience it as a book.
As a reading experience, yes. Well, it's an interesting reading experience because, I guess the way you've written it is it forces us to create the narrative.
I'm not helping you out too much.
No. But the way the narrative is structured, there's no like a simple story that we can follow from beginning to end. As a reader, by telling it in four different points of view, you force us to put together the story. And that's, I think, what I find very disturbing, because you force us to go through all these horrible details that you pull out of all the four different backgrounds and put them together and put together the narrative ourselves. And I guess that's just the style of this telling. I guess it's an oral history style.
It's also, you know, it would be typical of the two characters. You know, in other words, a psychiatrist. And I was conscious of that when I was writing, deliberate. I think it's why I picked a psychiatrist. She, by her very profession and training, is not drawing conclusions. And Helen, because of her psychosis, and it cannot draw conclusions. And so you, the reader, must.
That's what makes it interesting. And I'm wondering, did you look at any other, I guess, forms of this oral history, the multi-threaded narrative? I'm thinking when I talk, this book reminds me quite a bit of the most recent Chuck Palahniuk book, which is the story of a serial killer, and it's told from all the points of view of people who knew him before and after he was a serial killer. So he based this very deliberately on some oral histories. There's the life of Jarby Crash, one of the lead singer of the Germs, and Edie Sedgwick. So I'm wondering, did you look at some of those volumes?
No, I didn't look at those, although I like those books very much. And I haven't read this book, although I, you know, will do so now, unless it will make me feel bad. Will it make me feel bad?
Oh, I don't know. No, I think this book, your book might make Chuck feel bad. It's more likely the case. Susanna, tell me, what are you working on now?
I spent 6 months last year in Germany because I had a fellowship at the American Academy in Berlin, which is this quite extraordinary place where you are very well taken care of and given a researcher and a translator, if you like, and you are fed and you are just there to do research. And I was there to really to look about, which is something I need to do for a book. But also, I want to write a novel about the last days in Berlin before the Red Army arrives, which were very tumultuous, terrifying days, and the aftermath of that in 1945 of the conquest of the city, the taking of the city by the Russians. It's very controversial, just the fact that many of the things I read were extremely anti-Churchill and anti-Eisenhower, which, of course, as you know, a good American, shocked me. How could anyone say anything bad about Eisenhower? But there's a lot of historical opinion that faults him for the fall of Berlin, and there was a deal with Stalin. Anyway, I'm writing about this and completely, you know, fascinated by it.
Well, I guess, as I understand, you were originally going to write about some English fascists.
Yes, I was going to write about Dinah Mitford and her husband, Oswald Mosley. And I really, for the first 2 months there, read about them, everything I could find. And I grew so to loathe the main character, Dinah Mitford, that I actually had to put it aside. Because I thought, you know, there's, even being tough-minded, even being objective, even with all of this research, I there is no possible way that I can make her in any way an acceptable character. I mean, you may not like Helen, but you You don't loathe her, I don't think, and you accept her, don't you? In the new book, in the
yeah,
Big Girls.
Yeah, no, it just.
I mean, you may not love her the way I do, but you don't dislike her.
No, she's a fascinating character, and you understand her, but given the fact that you managed to make a woman who kills her own children a sympathetic character, I find it hard to believe that there's anybody else out there.
Well, 6 million Jews is a little, is a little harder.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, Diana Mitford and the Mosleys, unspeakable. I just didn't, and also I was really rather revolted by what I was reading, and I felt I couldn't write about it well.
And so you have chosen, who are your characters in your new book? Do you know yet?
A German couple who are in Berlin in those last days. I was very, very influenced, I think, and I have to be careful not to steal too much from it. A book called A Woman in Berlin by Anonymous. It's nonfiction, and it's a journal written by a woman, a young woman, who was there when the Russians arrived. And, millions of women were raped in the first few weeks.
This sounds like another uncomfortable and disturbing book by you.
I hope so.
We'll look forward to being deeply discomfited, disturbed, and having our dreams annihilated for several weeks.
That's very Freudian of you.
Oh, good. We've been speaking with Susanna Moore. Her new book is The Big Girls. Thank you for joining me, Susanna.
Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.